Rabbi Lipner regrets being unable to attend it this evening, although for good reason he's attending a wedding. He nevertheless asked me if I would take the honor of welcoming everyone and the privilege of introducing our evening and the esteemed rabbis of the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion, Beit Midrash Zichron Dov of Toronto. While the Haggadah speaks about the four sons who cover the spectrum of intellectual and perhaps moral backgrounds, this evening we are most honored to host four who are in the category of Chachamim. The Kollel truly continues to be a blessing to Jewish Toronto, and Sher Tefillah has been blessed to be able to take advantage of their presence in the city. Over the years, we have had many opportunities to listen, enjoy, and truly grow from their words of Torah, and we are certain that tonight will be no different. On behalf of Sher Tefillah, I want to thank the esteemed Kollel rabbis for helping to enhance our Pesach and the tables we will all sit around. May the beauty of the insights that you share with us this evening help us merit, this being the last time we will need to say L'Shanah Ba'a B'Yerushalayim. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you again to everyone for coming. And it's nice to see everyone, especially some of the familiar faces from the normal Wednesday night cheer. The source sheet for my little chunk here, it says Don Isaac Abarbanel. If everyone has a copy, there's a little map at the top. The goal right now is just to look a little bit at the biography of the Abarbanel. I think there are a couple extra copies here. As well as a comment from his Haggadah, and see how perhaps a little bit of his bio is reflected in that comment. So I made it as clear as possible, and hopefully that will be good, because we're going to go fairly quickly just for the sake of time. So the Abarbanel, his name is Yitzchak Abarbanel. We oftentimes have the term Don put onto the front, and even I have one of his svarim here. It says Don right in the front. That is not his actual name. That means Lord Isaac Abarbanel in our terms, for lack of better explanation. And he got that because, you see in the first dot underneath the map, Don Isaac Abarbanel was born in 1437 to a distinguished family in Lisbon, Portugal, and eventually becomes treasurer and close counsel to King Alfonso V, following in the footsteps of his father, who was also very close to the royalty. And he had a very good relationship with King Alfonso. However, as King Alfonso gets older, his son, who's very power-hungry, starts to make moves for the throne. And a few of various events happen. And at the end, there were a number of threats against his Alfonso's son, who is King Juan. And the Abarbanel was falsely accused of treason, and he fled Portugal to go to Spain. And there he kind of rebuilds and tries to settle down, as it were. His family comes from Portugal. And there he eventually gets in with the court, who at that time was Isabel and Ferdinand, which we know from, obviously, Columbus, but also the expulsion from Spain. At the bottom of these dots, I put a dot of a YouTube video, and you can see there's a YouTube video of two men entering into the royal archives. It's probably from the 70s or 80s, and they pull out an old ledger, and they open it up, and here is the stamp of approval for Christopher Columbus. They flip a few pages, and here's the stamp of approval for kicking all the Jews out of Spain. It's a very quick timeline there. They were very close together. And I showed this to my fifth grade Judaic studies class in Nashville, Tennessee, which is where I was living before this, and they were very bored by it, and I was blown away, because nobody talks about the fact that they're almost simultaneous events. It was an old video, so they were not interested. So he eventually, obviously in Spain in 1492, he has to leave. And I put in the dot here, he himself writes that he left with 300,000 Jews from Spain on foot. Some people argue against that number and say it was a little bit smaller. But suffice to say, he was the leader of the community at that time and was literally part of the expulsion. He experienced it. And then on the map, it just traces where he went through the rest of his life. Basically going around the boot of Italy, ending up in Venice, where he passed away in 1508. And what he writes in most of his commentaries, in various different parts, especially in the introductions, he references his own life experiences. And when he started writing, he references his life saying, I was very peaceful, my life was peaceful, I had status, I had money, I had wealth, people respected me, rabbis came and learned in my home, and then I lost it all, And I thought, maybe it's because I didn't spend enough time with Torah. So now I've decided to write commentaries. And he wrote very, very quickly. I put in one of the dots here, I say that Yehoshua Shoftim and Shmuel, which is this sefer, apparently he wrote in 6 months. I was reading earlier this afternoon, after printing the source sheet in the introduction, the printer's introduction to his Haggadah, that he actually wrote them in a total of, well, Yehoshua in 14 days, Shoftim in 24 days, and Shmuel in 6 weeks. He took, you know, it was a vacation then. But so either way, very, very, very short periods of time. So he was obviously very skilled at what he did, very intelligent. He knew his stuff and very, very motivated. And that's what I want to look at now in Source 1, where he talks about in his introduction to Zevach Pesach, which is the title he gave his Haggadah, and he says as follows, Amarti Eis La'asos L'Hashem, I said it's time to act for God, Perusha B'Haggadah of Pesach, I'm going to write a Perush of the Haggadah of Pesach, Ma'akip B'Inyani HaGalus V'Sibosav, which will discuss exile and the reasons for exile, Ufane HaGa'ula, the manner in which redemption will occur, Beniflo Seha, and the wonders of redemption, Kol El Parshios V'Dorshim Tamim Nichbadim V'Chadashim Lo She'erum HaRishonim Etukim Edvash V'Nofis Tufim. Everything I'm going to say, all the explanations I give will be wonderful, sweeter than honey, honey dripping from honeycombs. Ve'kara Shema Mamar Hazeh Zevach Pesach. And I'm calling it Zevach Pesach. Zevach means an offering, and Pesach obviously is Pesach. Why? Kihu zivchei Elokim miruach nishbara, because it is an offering to God from a broken spirit. Kind of paraphrasing a pasuk from Tehillim, but he's referring to himself that he is that broken spirit, and he's trying to console himself. He's trying to rebuild his own life through Torah, through explaining the Haggadah. Now, in source two, we're going to look at one of his actual comments and a question that he has on the Haggadah. At the beginning of his Haggadah, he goes through 100 questions, and then throughout he answers them. And just for the sake of time, I'm just going to paraphrase here. You have the Hebrew and my translation. Please, God, it's clear enough. But basically, on the title here, I put it Zevach Pesach on Dayenu, which is not correct. I was typing this up in the airport at 8:30 on Monday night, and my son was going crazy trying to lick every single surface there. So my wife and I were going even crazier than he was, and so I was thinking about Dayenu. Which is not what we're going to talk about now. This is in Avadim Hayinu, where you say, Ilu lehotzi HaKadosh Baruch Hu es avaseinu mitzrayim. If God had not taken our forefathers out of Mitzrayim, we would still be slaves there. And so the Abarunel says, okay, great. He took us out of Mitzrayim. But what did we gain? Think about his own life. He's been kicked out of multiple countries. He says, maybe we would have had a better life back in Mitzrayim as slaves than we would now in Galus Edom v'Yishmael. In under the Christians, under the Catholics, under the Muslims, maybe it would have been better. So what is the Haggadah telling us now? It's a sharp question, especially, and he's asking from his own life experience. And he also gives an answer, and this is under the gray box, where he says there are three things that we gained. One, I'll just very, again, summarizing, the greatness of the Jewish people was known to the world. They saw the miracles. They heard about the miracles. You hear about this in terms of Yisro heard the miracles. Rachav Hazona and Perek Beis of Yeshua in the second chapter of Sefer Yeshua talks about the miracles that occurred. Also, number two is the tremendous honor that we gained, ignoring the rest of the world. Just the honor that we have as individuals and as a nation having been taken out through these miracles. And then finally, we got the Torah. And I thought that was perhaps the most significant of the three, because that's the one that he's focusing on in this whole enterprise. He's writing a perush on the Haggadah. He's going to the Torah for consolation, for catharsis. I thought it was also interesting, just as a side note, that 1 and 2, do we always see that in our world? Did he even see that in his own world? And because he's been kicked out of countries. So if he hasn't seen that in his world, yet he's writing it, what does that tell us? That's just a thought for later. But now on to number three. Where this really just brings home his whole goal here. Where he says, Kishach alafar nafshi amarti nigzarti. My soul fell to the ground. I prostrated on the ground and I said, I'm doomed. Nigzarti. Everything's over. He's lost everything. My life is in shambles. Dibarti ayani el libi. Lama tika ish nidham ucholem chalom. Lama tamus belo itecha. Why are you giving up like this? Why are you acting so shattered? Why are you acting like somebody who's in a dream or a nightmare, as it were? Tzadik hu Hashem ki kol derachav mishpat. No, God is righteous. Sim na kavod Hashem v'turaso te'egeh. Give kavod to Hashem. Think about the Torah. Look into the Torah. That's what we have. That's our lifeline. Drosh mal sefer Hashem pigudei mesamchei leiv kihem makor ma'im chaim be'eros baros. Look in, delve in, and you'll find. And that's exactly what he did. And for me, that was the most powerful thing. His commentary is very interesting. The answer that he gives to his question is interesting, especially in light of his own experiences. But the very act that he's undertaking here, of asking that question, of answering it, and he was put into that position of writing this sefer because of his life experiences, that was the most important thing. Because I found his ideas are beautiful, his bio, his life is fascinating. But when you think about the ideas in the context of that bio, that's where things really, really become amazing, and he becomes a role model. And just to conclude here, his source for this is from Rav Soloveitchik, as recorded by Rav Schechter in one of the journals that YU puts out. And I put the link in here for the original Hebrew. This is my translation, where Rav Soloveitchik says as follows. The Masorah passed from one person to another through two conduits, or through channels, explanation and fascination. And he was talking to Musmachim of YU, rabbis that had been given smicha through YU in 1961. And he says these are the two key elements of passing over tradition to another person. Explanation obviously is logical. You're explaining something. You're giving over facts and information. But the real crux is the fascination. That has nothing to do with facts or information. It's all about experience. And it's not even about guiding somebody else's experience, it's about your experience. And allowing others just to see your experience. Meaning to say, me seeing the Barbanel is me witnessing and being fascinated with his role model, with his very essence, who he is, and the tradition that he's giving over to us when we read his commentary. And he says that's really the crux. And he gives examples that if you're teaching somebody how to daven, you don't point at the siddur all the time and flip the page for them and say, you have kavana here, you have this kavana there. I mean, you have to have the basic facts there, but the actual experience should come through them witnessing you having that experience. And that's really what I found myself seeing with the Barbanel. And God willing, that's something that we ourselves can think about when we read the Haggadah, or really when we experience the Haggadah, and that we can give that to others through our own experience. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Ziering, the Iskan Rosh Beit Midrash and our Beit Midrash. I want to focus on a line in the Haggadah which is as famous as it is enigmatic. And we all know, in the middle of the Haggadah, when we're describing leaving Mitzrayim, we read, "Vayotzeinu Hashem miMitzrayim." Hashem took us out of Egypt. Lo yidei malach, lo yidei saraf, lo yidei shliach. Not through an angel, not through whatever exactly a saraf is, a fiery angel, not through a messenger. Ela kadosh baruch hu bechvodo uvaatzmo. Except God Himself took us out of Egypt. It's very nice. It's a great message. God Himself swooped down, took us out, didn't send anybody. The problem glaring us in the face is that true? No. We know the names of the messengers. Can we name them? Moshe, another one. Aaron, right? That's not exactly how the story went. It's really nice to say, but it didn't happen that way. That's not what happened in Mitzrayim. In fact, we get this whole fight between Moshe and God. Moshe doesn't want to go. He goes back and forth for a week, and Hashem gets angry at him. A big deal is made in the Torah about the fact that there was, in fact, a messenger, and his name was Moshe. Rabbi Soloveitchik, on this line, says that because of this, this is why we don't mention Moshe's name, to highlight that there was no shliach, which only begs the question. We don't mention his name, that doesn't mean he doesn't exist. He was there, we know he was there. We open Chumash, we know he's there. Everyone knows he was there. So what is the Haggadah telling us when it says that God took us out himself, not through a shliach? It's simply not true. So Rabbi Soloveitchik's uncle, Rabbi Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, suggested one answer, which is nice. And he said, well, maybe that's exactly the point. Because Moshe, when he says he doesn't want to go, he turns to God and he says, who am I that I should go? And what does God respond? Don't worry about it. I got your back. And I'm behind you. Who gave the mouth to people to speak? You're not speaking. It's me. You're just a puppet. But I'm really there. So don't worry about it. So Rabbi Soloveitchik's uncle, the other Rabbi Soloveitchik, said maybe that's what's going on, is that, yes, it's true, Moshe did it, but the message is that even when it looks like Moshe's doing it, no, God is really acting through him. It's really not Moshe, it's God himself. But it still doesn't answer the question, because Moshe did it. The definition of shlichut, of sending a messenger, is someone else doing something for you, and no matter how much help you give them, and it's clear that Moshe himself couldn't split the sea if someone wasn't helping him just a little bit. That's clear. Still, Moshe is the main character of the story of Mitzrayim. So what does it mean that it wasn't a shliach? So the Shibboleth Halekut, writing in Italy, suggests something which at first glance is quite cryptic, and I want to just unpack it a little bit. And he says, you know what, it's true. Moshe did all the makot, or Aaron did the makot, and Moshe helped split the sea. There was one thing in Yetzias Mitzrayim he didn't do. One. And that was Makas Bechoros. 10th makah, God himself came down. And because of that moment, we say that it's as if the entire thing was done by God himself. So that's nice. You've solved the problem technically, and now you've said, okay, fine, we have one moment. There wasn't a shliach, there wasn't a messenger, it was God. Great. We still have another question, which is, so what? There were 9 other plagues and the splitting of a sea besides for that moment. Sure, that was what convinced Paro to let us go. But Moshe was there, so what does it matter? Why Makas Bechoros? Why is that so important? That God did that himself, and therefore because of that we say it's as if God did the entire thing start to finish by himself with no help. So here I think we just need to take a step back and understand why Makas Bechoros is so important. Because Makas Bechoros isn't just mentioned at the end. It's actually the first thing that's mentioned. All the way at the beginning, Hashem already tells Moshe, at the end, if this doesn't work out, the first 9 don't work out, there's going to be a Makas Bechoros at the end. I'm going to kill the firstborns at the end. The entire story starts and ends with Makas Bechoros. And more than that, right after Yetzias Mitzrayim, we get a bunch of laws, not the laws you would have expected. You would expect that we get laws like, I don't know, Shabbos, which we do get, but I don't know, maybe Kashrus, other laws that take up day-to-day life, we don't. We get the laws of redeeming the firstborn sheep and donkey and redeeming the firstborn. We get all these laws about firstborn. In fact, that's what you put in our tefillin. In addition to Shema and V'hayem Shema that talk about accepting God and accepting mitzvot, we put these paragraphs about the firstborn, all these laws about redeeming firstborns. And it seems like if this is all true, that we start and end the story with the firstborn plague, we bracket the story with mitzvot that highlight the importance of the firstborn, that maybe the key to the story is there in the firstborn. And in fact, God says that the purpose of Yetziat Mitzrayim is to take us out because we are B'ni B'chori Yisrael. We are the firstborn of God. So perhaps what this all points to is that the Seder really is about firstbornness, firstbornhood. I don't know what the proper word for it is, the status of being a firstborn. But what is that? What is the role of the firstborn? So here's an idea which I think is very nice from Rabbi David Foreman. It's in his new book, which I reviewed for the Kollel a few weeks ago. He said, the role of the firstborn in a family is to be the bridge between the parents and the children. Right? The firstborn was around before any of the other kids. He's the oldest. He's the closest in age. He's experienced the most that the parents have. He acts as the second parent. He's the person who shows the other kids the ropes, who teaches them the values of the family because he was there first. He was the only one who got the parents to himself. He's that bridge figure between the parents and the rest of the family. And he said, you know what Mitzrayim was about? It was about God taking us as his Bechor, taking us as the nation who would be responsible for conveying his values, his messages from God to his other children, to all the other nations in the world. And therefore, we bracket the story with all this discussion about the firstborn, about mitzvahs that remind us of the firstborn, and God punishing the mitzvah for not letting his firstborn go by killing their firstborns, by making sure that their family structure, their potential to pass on their values would be destroyed because they wanted to stop God from choosing his own firstborn. So I think the Shiboli HaLeket is actually very profound, and he says, you know what? In the end of the day, the entire Seder, all the miracles, it's true, Moshe did it. But at that moment, when God said, I'm going to show you how important it is for me to take my firstborn, to appoint you as my emissary, to teach the world my values, and I teach that by punishing the Mitzrayim specifically for not recognizing the value of my firstborn, that I will do myself. And that value, the fact that we were chosen as his firstborn, the fact that God did it himself, that alone is enough to make it as if God did the entire story of Yetziat Mitzrayim by himself. Because at the end of the day, what's important is that he took us as his own, and our responsibility as we leave the Seder is to carry that responsibility and to carry on his message from our parent, our Father in heaven, to the other children, to the other nations of the world. Chag Kasher v'sameach. And
thank you. And I want to, on behalf of the Beit Midrash, I want to thank Rabbi Lipner for hosting us. Granted, he couldn't be here, but he made everything possible, as he does for our programming throughout the year, for which I am most grateful. I also want to note that there are sign-in sheets somewhere around the room. Does anybody know where they are? There's at least one over there. If people would like to get the link for the audio recording of tonight's program, we will send it out, God willing, to those who sign in on there. And I also wanted to note our Seder companion on the Haggadah, 20-plus Torah thoughts on the Haggadah. God willing, there will be hard copies of this available here starting this Shabbos. So make sure you get it. Sorry? Oh, they're already upstairs. Excellent. They're already. Don't go running now. Okay, so my thought, I don't know if you've caught on, but we've been going through the Haggadah. So we've gone through the fours, and we've gone through Lo Ayideh Malach, that Hashem says, I did this all myself, I took them out myself. And now what we're up to is one of the oddest parts of the Haggadah. And I want to frame it by showing you my first source, for those who have the sheet that says at the top, punishing Egypt, justice or revenge. My first source is a classic, in which the Gemara talks about how when the Jews go through the sea, Lo Karav Ze El Ze Kol Halayla, Ze, this one, did not draw close to this one all night, and through a midrash that is more complicated than an 8 to 10 minute Dvar Torah will allow, the Gemara says it's referring to the angels. The angels wanted to sing to God when the Jews were crossing through the sea and the Egyptians were drowning, and God said, my deeds, my creations are drowning. You can't sing at that point. Granted, the Jews are able to sing, and Hashem appreciates our song, because we're the ones who are saved from destruction. However, it's inappropriate in general for us to glorify the destruction of Hashem's creations. That's my background for this. We don't glorify destruction, even when it is deserved. And so my problem is source number two, which we're not going to read through right now, but people will definitely recognize it as the part of the Haggadah at which people generally go into the kitchen to make sure that the food is okay. Or the children leave the table to do something with the afikomen. Or others who are at the table who maybe are concerned about the afikomen look after the children and see what they are doing with the afikomen. This is the math part of the Haggadah, the part that gives PTSD to the accountants who are just getting over all their tax work. As we get to the math. How many times were the Egyptians struck at the sea? Oh, I don't know. Well, we have a sentence and it employs four different terms for destruction or five different terms for destruction. Multiply that out by one finger of God and the hand of God and 10 fingers and who knows. And you end up with the Egyptians being struck 50 times, 200 times, or 250 times at the sea. And I, growing up, had no idea what in the world this was doing in my Haggadah. What is this? What does it add? are we free associating? What exactly is it that's happening at this stage of the Haggadah? That was one problem. And I have two more questions that go with it. My second question is, first of all, why are we playing up Egyptian suffering? But second, what does it mean when you say that they were struck 200 times? There's an angel there with a rod hitting them 200 times. They drown 200 times. What are we talking about when we say they were struck X number of times at the sea? That's my second problem. And then the third problem is, and this is more just an overall question, we're supposed to learn pedagogic lessons from different parts of the Haggadah. What are we supposed to learn from this about teaching our children? You don't want to get hit 250 times. Okay, check. What are we supposed to get out of this? So, there is a view attributed to the Vilna Gaon, which says that when the Haggadah says, it's really a Medrash quoted in the Haggadah, but when the Medrash says that they're hit 250 times, it means, yeah, God increased their punishments 50-fold, 200-fold, 250-fold. But it's not the only way to read it. Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin was the last head of the yeshiva in Volozhin at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, and he had a different approach to this. If you take a look at source number 3, I brought you the Hebrew and my translation into the English. I'm just going to read from the English in the interest of time. And he says, each of the pursuers of Israel met an unusual death according to the way he had harmed Israel when they had lived in Egypt. In other words, you're not being hit 250 times. Rather, there are 250 types of punishment, each one calibrated for a particular Egyptian, for a particular type of slave driver. The ones who did it this way got punished in a way that fit. The ones who did it that way were punished in a way that fit that. But each one in accordance with his conduct when the Jews were slaves in Egypt. And he notes, at Mariv, in the evening, one of the blessings that we say speaks of Hashem taking us out of Egypt and punishing the Egyptians. But it says, et rod fehem ve'et sonehem bitamot tiba, that God drowned the rodfim and the sonim. What's a rodef?
Pursuer.
What's a sone?
Hater.
A hater, an enemy, right? What's the difference? Says the Nitziv, says Rabbi Berlin. The answer is that some of the Egyptians were pursuing us because they hated us. And some of them were pursuing us because that's how they made their living. They were in Pharaoh's army. They showed up that morning. The work order said, run after the Jews, and they ran after the Jews. So Hashem says, I'm going to differentiate between them. The people who hurt you because they get a thrill out of it are going to suffer in a way that is appropriate for somebody like that. The people who were, quote, following orders are not saints. They're going to get punished too, but not in the same way as somebody who takes pleasure in it. That's what the Nitziv, what Rabbi Berlin writes, and he shows in a series of Midrashim, which I brought you in sources 4, 5, and 6, how the language of the Midrash fits this. The Midrashim that record this math idea of 50 plagues, 200 plagues, 250 plagues, are actually all speaking of justice. Number 4 introduces this idea of the math by quoting a verse from Tehillim, from Psalms, speaking of God as performing justice. Source number 5 points out that in the song the Jews sing at the sea, Az Yashir, we speak of the Egyptians drowning in 3 different ways, as straw, as stone, or as lead. And the Midrash says, because each one had a fate that was unique to what they had done. Ditto in the language in source number 6. As a matter of fact, Rabbi Berlin says, we preface the Shira, the song of the Jews going through the sea, or the song the Jews sing after they go through the sea, by saying, Vayar Yisrael es hayad agdola asher asah Hashem b'mitzrayim, that the Jews saw what God did to Egypt, and it says, Vayaminu b'Hashem, they trusted God. Now they believed in God. What? Blood didn't do it for you. Frogs didn't do it for you. Lice didn't do it for you. All 10 plagues didn't impress you enough. You didn't have faith in God with those. It was only when you saw what happened at the sea. That's what convinced you. Says Rabbi Berlin, no, it's not that. It's that this was the most explicit example of God saying, I pay attention to what's going on in this world. I'm watching what's happening. And I'm going to respond in kind. A statement that God actually sees and watches, right? We spend our lives longing for this, longing for a demonstration of divine attention, right? Think about what it would mean for us. to suddenly have a moment when it would become crystal clear that God sees the events of our lives and that he responds to those events. That's what they experience at the sea in a much clearer way than a one-size-fits-all plague of blood. And so, yes, at that point, writes Rabbi Berlin, that's when the Jews are able to truly believe. I also brought you source number 8, where Yitro as well, according to the sages, Moshe's father-in-law, comes to this belief because he hears about the sea. So number 1, I think that's why it's recorded here in the Haggadah. It adds a lot, this element of personal attention from God and personal justice. Number 2, I think it's not there in order to glorify suffering. It's there in order to say God responded to each person in kind and reacted to their deeds. Last point, what pedagogic lesson do we learn from here? I think we learn a great lesson from here. We had many prophets in Tanakh who were people of emet, who were people of truth, who wanted to see God punish people according to their deeds. I brought you two examples, one Eliyahu and the other one Yonah, in sources 9 and 10. But we find it with Moshe, we find it with other prophets. They would like to see God exercise justice. And I think that's a basic human trait. We seek order in this world. We seek fairness in this world. Now, as we grow up and we realize that we don't want 100% justice for ourselves necessarily, we may mellow out. You know, we want the lollipops. We don't necessarily want the punishment part of it. But the Navi, the prophet, doesn't mellow out and says, I don't want a margin for error. I want there to be order. I want God to watch and I want God to respond. And I think that resonates for the Jews when they see what God does to Egypt. And I think it resonates with our children as well. On one level, the story of the Exodus is God's fulfillment of a promise to bring our ancestors to the land of Israel. On a second level, it's God emancipating the Jews and saving them from servitude. But on yet another level, it's a story of justice. It's a story of right and wrong and punishment of the guilty. It's a statement that although we rarely see it, God does want justice in this world. And I think it's important beyond Pesach. It's important in the way that we talk about God, not just to describe God as some kind of Santa, borrowing from elsewhere, or as an invisible landlord, but as a judge, motivated by a desire for justice. So hopefully this will make the math portion of the Haggadah a little bit more meaningful this year. I hope that you benefited in general from our 4 thoughts this evening. Please do take the Seder Companion from upstairs now that I know that it's already there. I wish you a wonderful, meaningful Pesach, and there will be an announcement by my very good friend, Michael Mammon. I'd like to thank